Welcome to the Tuesday, December 9th, 2014 meeting. We're going to talk about our closed session, and we discussed, we conferenced with our labor negotiators and talked about ongoing negotiations. We have an item also. We have a student personnel issue, a stipulated expulsion. We need action on that item, so I'm looking for a motion on that.
I'll move approval of the recommendation.
I'll second.
So, okay, motion by Mrs. Roger and a second by Mrs. Sheffer. Is there any further discussion? Okay, seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed or abstentions? It passes 7-0. Thank you. Okay, so we've taken care of that. We also discussed in closed session some existing litigation and a possible settlement regarding PE hours for the elementary students. Okay, so we are now at a consensus on the order of business, and I would like to offer a change. We have an auditor's report. I understand the auditor has other places to be this evening, other reports, and so forth. So I would like to move that to the first presentation, we'll call it, guest this evening. Mr. Prater, Dr. Prater.
Yes, thank you. I'd like to, we have this great opportunity to have Dr. Crocker, the county superintendent of schools, sort of in the final days before he goes on to another journey in life, and he has offered to issue the oath of office for all of you this evening. The recently elected. Sorry.
Okay, good. So I think it's the newly elected or reelected. Yeah. Right. So you have a copy of the oath, I think, there at, yeah. And so if you will repeat after me, raise your right hand. I, in your name, do solemnly swear that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States. And the Constitution of the State of California. Against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that I will bear true faith and allegiance to the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the State of California, that I take this obligation freely without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion, and that I will well and faithfully discharge the duties upon which I am about to enter. Congratulations.
Just want to remind my fellow newly elected board members that we have some papers to sign here. It looks like in triplicate. It's not enough that you swore. You have to put it in writing, too. Welcome to the United States. Okay, we are ready for the comments.
I'm going to abstain because I think I just participated primarily in a closed session.
Okay. So all in favor accepting the minutes from November the 18th, correct? Okay. Say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? It passes 6-0 with one abstention. All right. We're ready to move on. We have our student representative to the board. We'll make a brief presentation to us on all the events at San Luis High School. And this is Jono. Take it away.
Thank you. I'll make sure to keep it short this time. So I'll start off with that our last week before school gets out, the week of the 19th, we have our week of giving and receiving. So we have a blood drive going on, a coat drive so people can bring and donate sweaters and blankets and stuff like that. We are also having a life water well, so a simulated well in the center of the of the quad where people can throw in change or money to donate towards clean water to people who need it. And we'll also have, for those who bring things in, as some sort of treat, you know, be it, you know, like a piece of candy or something like that, something that goes along with the they give and they'll receive. And along with that, we have our back to school night for trimester two, which is tonight. So all of the teachers are talking to parents about their students who are having their classes the second trimester, be it a part B or a part A. They should know what's going on in this second trimester. We also finished up our canned food drive. Last year we had around 400 cans, and this year we brought in 2,400. We expected to bring in 1,400 and surpass that by another 1,000. So everybody's really excited, and they're expecting to double it next year, so we'll see how that goes. And along with Spirit, we've done a really good job building up Spirit on campus this year. We've got Spirit shirts, we've got bandanas, we've got our whole Spirit section decked out in black and gold, and we've... I'd count it as a great success because I was Spirit Commissioner last year, so I know how much it's escalated. One of our only problems, though, is that we're trying to work with some of our custodial and cafeteria staff as they're not allowed to wear their Spirit wear shirts. So I'm working with Dr. Prater on that, and we're going to try to get it so that they
stay. All right, we are now going to go to the 2013-14 audit. Ms. Lang, you're going to...
I'm going to introduce Brian Ruff with Bavernick Trine and Day, who's going to present our audit as of June 30th, 2014. And before I let him start, I do want to acknowledge that, you know, a lot of people are involved when they come out and do this audit, and everyone has done a wonderful job, and once again, we had a clean audit. So I want to acknowledge and thank everybody that took part in that. And with that, this is Brian Ruff. He's our lead auditor, and he's going to go over the audit with you.
President Quisenberry, too, just really quick, we're going to ask the board for approval at this time instead of on the consent agenda, so that's okay.
Okay.
Not a problem. We'll do that.
Okay, thank you. Good evening to you. Thank you, Julie. We echo those sentiments. The district does an outstanding job of accommodating us and making sure that we get through all the information that we're required to get through as auditors. We come to the district twice a year on our annual visits. The first go-around is for our review of internal controls and our compliance testing at school sites. And the second time we come to the district is after your unaudited actuals are distributed and approved, and we review the numbers to make sure that they're fairly stated. And within your district this year, there were no audit adjustments. It's been a pretty common track record for your district's operation to have a pretty clean audit. You have clean audits in the areas of federal and state compliance, as well as internal controls. We do at times find minor items out at the school sites that we address during our interim audits, and we go over those items with management, and historically those items have been improved and corrected prior to our issuance of our report, so we appreciate that as well. So thank you again for your time, and to everybody at the district for assisting us in our audit.
Mr. Unger.
Yeah, just a couple of things. At some point, I don't know if we want to do it now, I'd like to have a discussion about audit firms, and not that I have a problem with what you guys do, but I know that there sometimes is concern when you have an audit firm that does your audits year after year, that there can be concerns about that. Now, I don't have a concern about that, but I do know that sometimes what happens is people will switch audit firms. In other cases, I don't know that that's an advanced agenda item. I kind of don't think so. The second thing is just a couple of small things I noticed. On page 42, it talks about employee groups, but it doesn't, the one I read it, it did not, and let me just double check before I stick my foot in my mouth, but I don't believe, it did not mention SEIU. So I don't know if, when it talks about contribution information, I don't know if that's something we need to add to that or not. And then the last thing is, when there was a list of school board members' terms, my term actually expires in 2016, not 2014.
So we will have to, we should include SEIU on page 42 as one of the union groups, I believe.
Assuming they have post-employment retirement.
They do. Okay. They do. Yeah. And then, you know, we, in terms of for the board's knowledge, and we can definitely talk about it, yeah. But basically what happens, and you can kind of let them know how to, your own firm, how do you guys, in terms of that transition point or switching up auditors, how's
sure,
that work?
Sure. What we've done internally, and it was required as well by the state, this came out from all the public entity issues that were going on with Enron and the like, where the PCOB required mandatory rotation of audit firms. That went to the state originally as a proposal for their governmental entities as well. The result of that was, after they went through and talked and discussed the issue at hand, was that audit firms can continue on mm-hmm. for a period of years or indefinitely, but the requirement would be a rotation of the lead audit partner every 6 years. So we've done that here already for your district. We were just discussing this. I don't have the number exactly, but I believe this is either my fourth or fifth year as the lead partner, and we do rotate that after 6 years at a minimum. At times, we've done it earlier as well, just as the balance of work flows for different partners within the firm.
Mr. Pinkerton, your light's on. Did you have something?
That was it.
Okay. Dr. Eisendrath Rogers?
I was curious about why it said not applicable after charter school, and Mr. Pinkerton explained to me that that's because our Bellevue Santa Fe has its own independent audit, and so this is separate and apart from what we do.
One thing I noticed that you talked a lot about was GASB 68, I believe. Could you just, for our benefit and maybe for the benefit of the public, explain what that means, and are there any implications for budgeting for us, or how an audit or our budget would look based on that?
Right. Well, the implication directly to the school district is, as you're probably well aware, the rates are going up dramatically for PERS and STERS, and what is going on now within the accounting disclosures is that there are actuarial studies being done to determine what the estimated liabilities for individual school districts would be throughout the state. That's being completed by one firm, and they're doing a sample basis testing to determine that the numbers are accurate and what have you. But it's going to be information that will be provided to us for next year's audit, and will dramatically increase the long-term liability of school districts. Now, that doesn't impact directly your operating effectiveness as far as what your cash on hand is and what have you, directly related to the statement of net assets, but it does, on a budgetary go-forward basis, impact what your rates would be within PERS and STERS and the contribution requirements. So that's the biggest impact of the pronouncement, is to realize that the liabilities are large and that they're out there.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Millar.
I just want to follow up on the Bellevue Santa Fe in separate audit. Us having them as a discrete unit within our audit was negotiated a few years ago as part of essentially an informal mediation about the equalization formula. And we undertook that to save them money. And so my question is, now that they have to have an independent audit, or who's paying for it, how much is it impacting?
They pay for it.
Okay. It was a good thing while we were doing it, but okay. Thanks.
Is there any further questions or comments? Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
For being here this evening, and I think we need to move acceptance of the audit.
I'll move acceptance of the 2013-14 audit.
Second.
It's a motion by Mr. Unger, a second by Mr. Millar. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor? Aye. Opposed?
Years of service dedicated to kids and to the wellness of our county's public education system. He's quite an extraordinary man, educator, and I've come to really appreciate all of his support and mentorship along the way. So, Dr. Crocker, on behalf of our school board, San Luis Coastal, we know rumors out that you like to go on walking vacation tours, and so Amazon is an amazing thing. And so, on behalf of our board, we would like to honor you with your next a tool for your next journey. And this is a touring walking stick.
Perfect.
And it comes in three parts, it even has a belt loop. And Dr. Crocker, thank you for everything.
Thank you, Eric. Okay. This is great.
Thank you very much. That's a wonderful gift. I have a set that's very old, so it's very appropriate. You must be looking in my closet or something there. So that's great. These are great great help. Well, thank you again. I appreciate the opportunity to just very briefly give you kind of an update in terms of countywide perspective. You have a copy of the annual report, which has been a regular presentation. It's a little bit dated because it's basically based on last year. As you know, it comes out in the spring. It'll be coming out again. And I wanted to compliment you on your report that came out, I guess, a couple of months ago or a month ago or so. It was very well done. As you know, the last couple of years, we've partnered with Cuesta. So the intention would be that Cuesta would be with us again. So you can certainly see that. And again, congratulations on those of you that are reelected to the board, and a tremendous congratulations on the passage of Measure D, of the bond measure. Just really, really well done. So, and certainly needed. So, I really compliment you as a board to move forward with that at a time when people aren't very interested in increasing their taxes. But the amount that was passed by here is a real tribute, I think, to the trust and really the confidence they have in the district administration, and you as a board. So congratulations. The legislature trying to react to that. Late 60s, early 70s. So you kind of fast forward. Again, I'm sure you probably realize this, that the change in both the funding formula and the funding methodology in California couldn't be more significant because we had developed, as you know, a system of categorical funds, a system of very heavily mandated actions from the state, and now you as a Board of Trustees really do have a very unique opportunity. And I know this first year is kind of getting your feet wet in it. I think Eric and his staff really developed a marvelous template, one that I know is helpful for you and certainly helpful for other districts. But I would just encourage you as the governing board, as you go through this year and the next year, to remember you really have that opportunity to let the instructional program drive the budget. And that's a wonderful opportunity. The governor is absolutely committed to this. He's really turning it over to us locally, you know, all of us that kept saying more local control, but we've got it. We really do. So I just encourage you and all of our boards to really take advantage of that. It could be easy just to do things like you've done before, which has been fine. But you really do have a tremendous opportunity. And as I said, it's one that is brand new over the last 40 years. So the whole funding and the coordination of your instructional program with a budget is a tremendous change, and it's a great opportunity for you. Common Core, which you know have heard a lot about, again, just as a perspective, in my career, we've moved from essentially no standards. We were really textbook driven, if you happen to be this textbook school or that textbook school. Then, as you know, several years ago, California, a number of states developed our own statewide standards, which I think was a huge step forward, long overdue, and now we're essentially in a system of nationwide standards. So there's been that's another tremendous change over time. I think the Common Core is exactly right on point. They are rigorous standards. I think from my perspective, since our own state had rigorous standards, I don't think it's a huge leap for most of our teaching staff. And in many ways, the fewer standards in the Common Core, I think, are appreciated by teachers. But it's different. And the first round of testing, when that happened, and the Smarter Balance, you couldn't live in more exciting times as a member of the Board of Trustees, and some real opportunities, I think. In terms of challenges, it's always the achievement gap. still there. It's there in this district. It's there countywide. I, as a person who grew up in legally segregated schools in another part of the country, to see our schools, not just here, but generally across the nation and in California, more segregated now than we were 20 years ago. There's a variety of reasons for that. But that issue of dealing with equity for students as well as excellence is a huge challenge for us. It's one we can't do by ourselves, but it's one of those things that I think we really need to mobilize our community around that issue. So that's a great concern, that we are, particularly those of us in coastal California, are living in increasingly segregated schools. Just the fact of the way it is. And so what can we do to address that, to try to moderate that in some way? It's a huge challenge, but certainly that's there, I think. For the county office, we'd like to say we have some things that are mandated, some things that districts ask us to do, and some things that we will take the initiative on kind of an entrepreneurial basis to try to do. So in terms of the mandated services, we've seen those increase. As you know, I don't know, 10 years ago, we moved into the whole fiscal accountability role. So we have the budget review, collective bargaining agreement review, and so forth. We now have academic oversight. So as we move through the LCAP process, the county office, in essence, will review the LCAPs again and have a degree of academic oversight. So our mandated responsibilities have increased significantly. In terms of what districts ask us to do, the significant change over the last several years for the county office has been a decrease in the number of special education students that we serve directly, because in one way or the other, districts are saying, we'll take care of those students. You don't need to do that anymore. And that's good. I think that's a very positive thing. We still serve a small contingent of severely handicapped students, but the vast majority of special education students are served in districts. So that's an area that we are not doing as much in. Districts still ask us to operate community schools for students that essentially are on the truancy path or are, you know, Dr. Jim Brescia will be taking over as county superintendent the first part of January. He's sworn in, I think, on the 3rd of January. I think most of you know Jim. He most recently has been the superintendent in Cayucas. Prior to that, had had a fairly significant time when he was the principal superintendent of St. Rose Catholic School. I first knew Jim when he was a math teacher at Flamson Middle School up in Paso Robles. We worked together. He's had a long relationship with Cal Poly also. So I'm very happy that he'll be moving into this office. I just leave you three things that he would say, or four things really, that he would say in terms of affecting student progress. Research will show there are primarily four factors that make a difference in terms of student success in school. One of them is the educational level of the parents. Secondly is the socioeconomic status of the family. The third one is who's in front of the students, the teacher, and who's in front of the school, the leadership. Well, we can't do a lot about the first two, We need to concentrate on who steps in front of those kids every day and who steps in front of our schools every day. So those are the two things I know he will be focusing on. You know, parents send us the best kids they have. They're not keeping another set at home. So it's our obligation to really focus, I think, on who's there as their teachers and who's there as their leaders. So I wish you well, and thank you very much for the walking sticks. I'd be glad to respond to any questions if you have.
Dr. Crocker, I just want to thank you for your eloquent and forthright advocacy for public schools and the students in our public schools. I've always enjoyed reading your viewpoints in the local paper. Maybe it's because I almost completely agree with you, but
always helps.
They always seem very calm, rational, and to the point. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you. Good. Congratulations, Chris, also. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Okay. Well, we are now at the annual board organization, which means that we will elect a new president and a clerk. And so I'm further nominees.
If you want the job.
Mrs. Sheffer, you want the job?
If nominated, I will accept.
If nominated, she will accept. Okay. So hearing no other nominees, I will close the nominations, and then we'll just take it to the vote, I believe. So all in favor of Ellen Sheffer as the president for the 15-16 school year? Would that be for the 15-16 school year? 2015 calendar year. Okay. All right. Thank you. That's right. Okay. Indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions? Welcome, Madam President. I would now like some nominations for the clerk of the board, Mr. Unger.
Yes, I'd like to nominate Marilyn Roger to be clerk of the board.
And we have the nomination by Mr. Unger and a second by Mr. Millar. Are there any further nominees? Okay, I'll close the nominations for that. All in favor of Marilyn Roger as clerk of the board, indicate by saying aye. Opposed? Abstentions? Welcome, Marilyn, as the clerk of the board. Thank you very much for stepping forward. And now I think it's time for us to take a break, Dr. Prater.
Yes, but before that, could I say a couple words about you, Jim? Would you mind?
Yes, yes, you may.
As is customary, upon the completion of your term as president, we provide our outgoing president with a few kind words, a card, and a very cool ornament that you may hang on your tree if you have one. And this ornament is a gavel. Just so you won't forget us each holiday season, Jim. But along with this gavel, each of us sign the card for you, and I will hand that to you. But some personal thoughts, having the opportunity to, and when I inquire as to why, you're reluctant to share, but what I've learned is that you spend a good deal of your week giving to people in the community that you live in, and you are president of the Rotary in Los Osos. You have a generous spirit, and not only have you given your career to giving to the betterment of children as an exceptional teacher. You now are back on the school board serving in this capacity, and I would I just have the greatest respect for you, and I think you've done an exceptional job as our president of the board, and I'm most appreciative. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and it really has been an honor to work with these people and to lead the board this year. I really appreciate each and every one of our members. They each bring some unique talents and viewpoints, and I think we work together very well, so it's been a very easy job for me this year. Thank you very much. And now we'll take a short break.
Okay, we're ready to reconvene. We are at item 6.02. I can follow the one.
Already. Well, yes and no.
Actually, we're at 6.03. See?
Yeah, this is our, there are some changes to this year's calendar, at least proposed. It has been vetted with Mr. Quesenberry and Mrs. Sheffer and Cabinet. And the change that you'll see is in lavender. And in lavender, those boxes represent Measure D study sessions, where we're recommending a 3-hour study session on Fridays, typically with one exception, from 9 to noon, once a month. And the purpose of that is to handle the business of Measure D and try our best to work through those details and the myriad of issues that come up with a facilities campaign. So we're adding that component every month. The busy month for board meetings, and I want to raise this, would be March 2015. Because of how the dates line up, we have 3 board meetings in the month of March, along with a study session on the 20th. And the reason for that is in April, we have spring break. And so we only have 1 board meeting in April. So those are the primary differences that I see. In addition, we have the July 14th board retreat. And I went ahead and put it there. Obviously, I did. It's for the board to see if that works. But beyond that, the difference here are the lavender board study sessions. And then in December, we also have 2 board meetings December 15th. However, there will likely be the CSBA annual conference the first week of December, so that one will likely need to be changed. But other than that, the calendar is presented for your approval.
Is there anyone from the public who would like to speak to this matter? Anyone from the board? How'd I do, Chris?
He's always the public. Go to the public.
Mr. Millar.
Thank you. So the study sessions, are they going to be, are we going to be making board decisions at the study sessions? They're going to be the same format that we've kind of been through in the past, just bringing us up to date, laying out things. And are they going to be
Click on it like some of the calendars and have it show up on our other calendars?
So after you've adopted these, I will publish this calendar to the website for your information and for the public to view. I will be sending Google meeting invitations to all of our staff people and yourselves included, and that will allow you to post it to your calendars automatically.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Anything else? Okay, all in favor of the 2015 board meeting calendar, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstention? Carries 7-0. Okay, so next we have the appointment of board members to committees and liaison posts. Dr. Prater?
Yeah, this each year we select or our board members are appointed to each of these committees, and it's pretty self-explanatory. There are the Central California School Financing Authority that Ellen and Mrs. Sheffer has been a part of for this year, the SLO County School Boards Association. There's the interest-based bargaining liaisons to the CSEA and SEIU groups. In addition, there is the Region 9C delegate for CSBA, which Mr. Buckman is, and as well as the, actually, I believe that's it for the appointments.
Mr. Millar?
Well, I feel that I need to make amends for my assignment last year to the County School Boards Association, where I managed to not be available for the only meeting that they had. So I am willing, if Ellen, I think Ellen's going to be pretty busy, to serve again on the Central California Schools Financing Authority. I assume it's just as time-consuming as it always has been.
Now, there's a meeting on Thursday. And
this, you know, Thursday?
Yes.
I can be there, unless you want to be there.
No, go right ahead.
All right. Okay, I feel
and
better already.
Does anyone else, is that post in contention at all?
Do we just do consensus on this?
Yeah. Okay. Is everyone all right with that? And then the other positions? Let's see. The SLO County School Boards Association.
Not necessarily reconstituting, but reinvigorating the County School Boards Association. So it may be more than one meeting a year, just so that you know.
Thank you, Mr. Unger. Thanks for raining on my parade.
Thank you, John. Thank you very much.
Is there a consensus for Mr. Quesenberry? Having received that news, are you still willing to serve?
As long as it doesn't exceed 5.
Oh, I think you're probably good with that. All right, you can take that up with Mr. Brush.
You can have an alternate, too.
That's right.
Some of these jobs.
Thank you.
All right, do we have a consensus on Mr. Quisenberry serving in that capacity?
Okay.
Do you want a formal alternate, or just to call on someone should you be unable to attend a particular meeting?
Yes, I'd like Dr. Eisendrath Rogers, because she looked up at that very moment as my alternate.
And I've actually held that position before, so I think I'm up to the task.
Great, right. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you.
I just want to caution you. You're welcome to have an alternate who can attend those meetings. Usually they're very casual, but when there's official business for the County School Boards Association, their bylaws only allow for one voting representative. Okay. So even though we've traditionally had an alternate who can attend the meetings, you won't have voting authority, which is why we had to nominate Mr. Unger to attend that last meeting to make sure that we had a legal voting rep there.
Well, this is just getting bigger and bigger for you, Mr. Quesenberry.
I think I can bear the load.
Okay, thank you. I'm sure you can. Okay, so now we're to interest-based bargaining units. So Catherine Eisendrath Rogers currently serves for CSEA. Do you want to continue that, or?
Yes, I'm going to continue that.
Okay, do we have consensus on the board for that?
Yes.
Cool.
Okay. And then Marilyn Roger for SEIU. Would you like to continue doing that?
I would like to.
All right. Consensus?
Yes.
Okay. Well, that...
Mr. Buck, I'm sorry.
Oh.
Already I'm usurping authority.
I only answer to Jim.
Thank you. Mr. Buckman.
This past year, we did agree to have a representative of the Tri-County Education.
Yes. Okay. All right. Thank you. Anything else before we move on? All right. The next item is correspondence. There is none with our board docs. Is there any correspondence to report having received since our last meeting? Then next we have public comment. So if I see Mrs. Devitt approaching the podium.
I'm not sure, is this on or not on?
It's on.
Mary Jo Devitt, San Luis Obispo. As all of you know, Mr. David Moore passed away suddenly on the 15th of November. And he was principal at Pacheco when all four of our children, James, Andrea, Gregory, and Carolyn, attended. So, of course, I work closely with David. He was there when the alternative program was adopted and was at Pacheco. At the same time, he was principal at Los Ranchos. And then when they closed Pacheco that time, then David went to Morrill Elementary. And actually, I do not remember how many years he was there, but he's a marvelous principal, marvelous person. And his wife, Kathy Moore, taught many years. She taught at Emerson, and then when Emerson closed, she went to Los Ranchos. And she even, I think she began at Quintana. I think she first taught at Quintana. So I thought it only fitting to pay tribute to Mr. Moore and his passing. Yeah, he was a huge contributor to the educational system and many changes in our district. I think Mrs. Shields and he worked together. I don't think there are any other principals, elementary principals here who worked with David. So I'm sure that she would agree with me on saying that that he was a great contributor. So I thought it important to honor David at the meeting. Thank you. Thank you, Mary Jo, for bringing that to his contributions to our attention. Thank you. Any other public comment at this time? If there's a topic of general interest, now's the time. If a member of the public wishes to wait until to address a particular agenda item, the forms are over there, and we encourage you to fill those out and hand them to Mrs. Holmes.
What we would like to do is during the board study session in January, which will be at BG&T, we'd like to demonstrate kind of the new buses and how it works and the difference between an old bus and one of the new buses in terms of the particulates and how that whole system works with our new buses. So hopefully you can make it. We're going to invite the media as well and kind of tie them into where we're moving as a district. So that's a positive thing for us. I was just at the CBO symposium down south, and so it was good to it's always good to kind of hear the latest in terms of the economy, where we're at, you know, kind of the future of the state, the nation, kind of the world view. And so a lot of positive feeling about where we're at as a state and as a nation and where the economy's heading. And so hopefully that, you know, hold strong, because as the economy goes, you know, school funding, property taxes, all of those, you know, things are definitely tied together for us. Other key things that are going to happen here at the beginning of the year that we're going to be paying attention to in terms of our staff, and that's some new laws about healthcare tracking with employees and how you have to report that to the IRS. So those are things that we're, you know, talking about, working on, and new restrictions in those areas. Also, new rules for STIRS and PERS kick in January 1st. And so kind of outlining, you know, there are certain things that used to be able to, you know, be tied into the STIRS and PERS benefits and now are no longer tied to it. And so that'll be important for us to share that information with the staffs at all of our school sites and throughout the district. And so we'll be doing that. Absence tracking. So new law kicks in where employees are able to earn sick leave, basically. So these are our employees that are not part of any of our bargaining units, and so setting up new processes for how we track those employees, how many hours they work, how much sick time that they accrue will be another thing that we're going to be working on. And then lastly, E-rate. So the E-rate system, which is kind of a federally subsidized program for technology, is changing. And so they're moving away from cell phones, different types of technology, and really focused on providing Wi-Fi at schools. And so that will have a budget implication for us in some ways, in that, currently they pay for a lot of our cell phone service plans throughout our schools, throughout our district, and so we'll have to look at that budget. But on a positive note, I think we can right now.
Any comments from the public about this topic? I have a question. The new buses that we have, how much did Annie Sharp's grant writing skills save us as a district?
So those buses are—they're couple hundred thousand dollars a piece.
Yeah, that's
so.
That's
so it's great, and we have two more buses available in our fleet that are possibly up for another grant in the future. And so Andy's already put those in, and so it's just a matter of whether the Air Pollution Control Board, whether they get the grant funds to be able to give those funds. So Annie's, kudos to her for getting out in front and putting us in a position where we can receive these new buses.
Yeah.
And I think you'll be amazed when you see the pollution that comes out of an old bus versus these new buses and the particulate traps and how they take those particles and ensure that the environment's safe is fantastic. You'll be really impressed.
Well, please express the board's appreciation.
I will.
Okay. Mr. Buckman.
Thank you. Ryan, we've had a brief discussion, I think, on email regarding seatbelts, and they're now being included on buses. So when we get over there, could Annie just sort of fill us in on what's happening?
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks.
Sure.
I appreciate that.
Mrs. Roger.
Mr. Pinkerton, I don't know if I heard you correctly. Is that a boardwalk scheduled for January or a study session scheduled for January at BG&T?
Boardwalk.
Boardwalk. Okay, thank you.
Sorry if I said set session.
Okay. Next, we have our educational services update.
Yeah, I just have a couple of previews of coming attractions. As we come out of winter break, our life gets filled with planning for next year, believe it or not. Seems like we just started, but we're starting to work on next year with forecasting enrollment projections and budget planning. And as the board is aware, we have a planning process that is somewhat uniform throughout the state. Dr. Crocker alluded to it, the local control accountability plan. Last year, as the first year of this requirement, we, and I think every other of the 1,000 school districts, kind of flew by the seat of our pants a little bit. There was no template for what that plan needed to look like, and no official reporting mechanism. And so we developed our own protocols. I think we did a very good job, especially with the amount of outreach that we attempted to do. It strictly is a local control decision for us. The A stands for accountability, and accountability will continue to be a tricky thing because there still will not be any accountability in terms of state tests and achievement targets. There's still, we will hopefully have our students tested this year, but that'll be the floor, that'll be the beginning of it. So our students haven't been measured under our new standards yet. That's why we are largely relying on our district assessments, some of which you'll hear about tonight. We talk about writing. We're relying on our own locally controlled measurement standards, and I think we're also well ahead of the curve there. The P, of course, is the plan. And what's nice is that the plan is not it's a map. It's not the territory, and we do now have a state template. And so next Tuesday, a week from today, we will be meeting with the County Office of Education. We will be reviewing what that LCAP plan needs to look like and what we need to monitor. You have to remember that the LCAP is a three-year plan. It's not an annual plan. It's a three-year plan that's annually updated, so we will be updating our plan. We don't need to and probably shouldn't try to rewrite the whole thing, but to really kind of look at our achievement targets, look at the goals we're trying to accomplish, and make those adjustments. So when you return from your CSBA conference next week, we will have been trained in the new reporting format, and we will have developed our solicitation and outreach plan, our calendar, and how we're going to go out to school sites, and we'll be able to share that with you next week. Another preview of coming attractions, and this is one we will be spending a lot more time as a board with in the spring, has to do with the area of science. And in some ways, we're kind of breathing a collective sigh of relief because it seemed daunting at first, but I think we're going to be fine. We have been working very hard, as you know, as a school district on the common core areas of language arts and mathematics, specifically reading, writing, math. We know that on the horizon is a new set of national standards in science, known as the Next Generation Science Standards. We have had the sense that even though we're kind of overwhelmed with Common Core, we're going to blink and all of a sudden fall behind in science. But last week we were fortunate. We were able to send a large team to a major science conference in Long Beach. We were fortunate in that both the national Science Teachers Organization, whatever that's called, and the State Science Teachers Organization met together in Long Beach. We didn't have to travel to Chicago or something for this conference. We sent a lot of our staff, or both of our directors, at this conference. It looked like this is pretty good stuff. We may adopt it again, and that may be what we move forward. It's just about a matter of how we, you know, tweak it. At the middle school level, I was just talking to two of our finest back there at the break at the middle school, and there'll be big decisions about whether we do an integrated model. We were just discussing this, or keeping our sort of physical and life science model, but we have such good middle school science teachers at both of our schools. I'm just quite confident they're up to that task. High school is going to be a challenge, and not terrible, but it will be tricky, and this is, like I said, a preview. We'll be spending a lot of time on this because there are really four issues that we will be going into much more depth with the board in terms of our high school science curriculum. The first is how best to incorporate some of the new standards, specifically in earth sciences and engineering, into our curriculum, because there are new standards that we currently are not teaching that will need to be infused. The second thing is what we're going to do about our two-year science requirement. We require 2 years of science for graduation. Most students take more than 2 years in high school, but we only require two. The Next Generation Science Standards is definitely a three-year science program. It is not a two-year program. And so that'll be a big decision for the board, is whether or not we keep a two-year requirement, knowing that not all students will get all the standards, or make a decision to require 3 years, which has other implications in terms of staffing, other programs, electives, credits, all those kinds of things. The third, and perhaps the largest one for us to figure out, is what we do about sequencing of science courses, especially as we start the freshman year. As you all are aware, all of our ninth graders go into high school taking an integrated science course. They take integrated science, they might take an integrated accelerated science class, they might take an integrated agricultural science class. But they all take ag science or integrated science. And that is not UC A through G approved. And that is a problem. It is not A through G approved. And we want to give all students, especially with the Next Generation Science Standards, A through G credit for their science classes. So we're going to have to make some decisions about that course sequencing beginning in the ninth grade. What that looks like, again, we're really trusting our teachers and our teacher committee to bring their best recommendation, whether it is a new type of integrated science, whether it is biology first, which is common throughout the nation, whether it's physics first. There's a whole physics first. And it will also have implications for ag science, because that ag science entry at ninth grade is where a lot of students get their science credits through. And there really is no such thing as ag physics, for example. So the decision we make at that entry level will also have implications on the ag department. Just a preview. So in early spring, we'll be bringing you our best recommendations in those areas. And because of the strength of our teaching staff, I'm sure we'll be quite in good shape.
Thank you. Is there anyone from the public who would like to speak to this topic? Okay. Bring it back to the board. Mr. Buckman.
Yes, thank you. I'm hearing you say that we've got to come up with all these new
classes, and we're going to need to accommodate them. And then I'm also hearing in the research and around the state, and I think even at higher education for student training, for teacher training, that we want to embed more things, that we want English to include science, we want history to include English. And so I'm just wondering if there's any talk about, so as we come to this third year of science, is that, can that be compensated in some way? And if there's been any talk of that at all, because it's kind of like, how do you have your cake and eat it too?
Well, I'm not sure. You know, again, this is a big topic for probably a future time, but I don't. One of the things we have to constantly think about at the high school, if you're speaking about a high school, is the regents of the University of California system and how anything we do gets approved for UC A through G, UCCSU A through G requirements. And so within the next generation science standards, there's a whole pathway where where the science is all integrated. We know we adopted a class last year in biotechnology, which is trying to infuse a couple of topics. And so I think that we need to continue to be creative, but we also want to make sure we're giving all of our students, especially in an academic area like sciences, the opportunity to get their college entrance requirements fulfilled. And so sometimes things that we try to integrate too much, or say, let's do this in the shop area, for example, or things like that, it's tricky getting those through the regents. It's possible, but it's trickier. So I don't know. That's just off the top of my head.
Anyone else from the board?
Anthony and I have been working, meeting with groups, construction management firms, doing it, getting all this background information to bring to you so that we fill those study sessions. And so that's upcoming. So I'm going to keep this one kind of short tonight, concise, because we are going to get a little bit more in depth in the discussion item.
Anyone from the public wanting to address this? Okay, then we will move on to item 9, resolutions. We have a resolution for a positive certificate of adequate funding, first interim report. Mrs. Lang.
Good evening again. Yes, we are done with our first interim, and I'll quickly kind of go over some of the changes that have occurred since we adopted the budget in June. As you know, when we adopt the budget, it's usually like in May or, June that we're building the budget, so a lot changes between that time and the time that we really find out what our property taxes are going to be and what our salary and benefits are going to be. So this has been adjusted for our property taxes, which fortunately have gone up since we adopted the budget. You'll see that further on down. We're currently about, it's actually more like $16 million over what we would be for LCFF gap funding. They just came out with a new template for that, and it turned out that we're about $16 million over instead of $18 million over. Our carryover amounts have been posted. We have adjusted our local revenues, as we always do. Those go up throughout the year. Our seabeds came in at about 100 more than we had anticipated when we built the budget. And we've made other adjustments to salary and benefits and other programs. If we can scroll down, we can go into some of the specifics.
Julie, let me ask you a question.
Yes.
Back up there to the $16 million versus
yes.
$18 million. Is that the equivalent of our difference between our old revenue limit and our
yes.
measure? Our,
right. Okay. The governor has increased the gap funding this year. So the gap between what you would be fully funded at LCFF and what they are this year. So this $1.7 million increase to our property taxes was entirely property taxes. They went up about 3.9% this year, which is an upward trend. We went up about 3.1% last year, and this is after a couple of years of it, actually. And then our local revenues, again, the billing accounts and the donations, those continue to go up throughout the year. So overall, our total revenues went up close to $2 million, $1.9 million from what we had budgeted originally. And our expenditures also went up. We had we've been doing some hiring, but we also had more retirees. So those kind of offset, but we still had to increase our salary and benefits by, what is that, almost $900,000, I guess? $800,000. Books and supplies, that's our carryover amounts that we budget. We actually have, if you look further down, you can see that our total carryover was over $3 million. So we put all of our carryover into the books and supplies category, and then as sites and departments know how they're going to actually spend that, it gets distributed to the other categories. So services and operations, some of that is probably carryover in there. Some of that is also donations for field trips and things like that, so that increased as well. And then the capital outlay was the amount that we didn't spend last year for the wireless went into this year's, so that part of that is carryover. Part of that is those buses that we just got, and I think some Common Core money in there also. So overall, our expenses went up by almost $5 million. The board approved the transfer back to Fund 20 to cover this year's retiree benefits. So we're going to transfer money out of Fund 20 into the general fund to pay for the retiree benefits, and then we're going to transfer it back to Fund 20 so that it'll be even. So overall, the change to the ending fund balance was about $4 million decrease. And then further down, it's just sort of a more detailed list of how we came up with that figure, all the different changes to the ending fund balance. We don't need to go over all of those specifically unless you have any questions.
So outside of the two, the buses that we received from the Air Pollution Control Grant were free. So we are purchasing, and outside of that, a new special education bus. That was one of the one-time purchases that was approved by the board. So I just want to make sure that's clarified.
Okay, and then this compares our unaudited actuals with our adopted budget and our first interim budget. And the reason we put in the unaudited actuals is because, as you know, every year we have this big budget, especially in our books and supplies account, means that our deficit isn't going to be as high by the time we end the year either. Right now we have deficit of about 4.9 million. Can't see that very well. Bringing our ending fund balance down to about 15 million. We imagine that by the end of the year we'll probably have about another $3 million that'll carry over and won't be spent. And then of course there's things that we can't spend. We have to set aside our revolving cash, our stores, all our restricted ending balances. We can't spend on things other than what we're allowed to spend them on. And then we have other balances that we choose to keep aside. And if you scroll down a little bit further, you can see that the balance that we have left after setting all these things aside is about $1.6 million. And I think after that we have a multi-year projection.
And I would say the key further thing, down. If you go down, just to, I'm going to add on sure. to it a little bit. Uh-huh. If you go back down a little bit, Kim. No, the other way. Sorry, up. So as you can see, what a lot of it was those one-time purchases at the initial budget that we did, those were taken out of the reserves and put into the expenditure. So that's why you see that major change between the two areas, right? I mean, in terms of why materials and supplies went up so much was we moved those expenditures up.
Now I think we can go to multi-year. Scroll down a little bit, two pages. Okay. So again, we're showing you the unaudited actuals to show you what a semi-normal year would look like. And then we have our first interim budget, which is this budget that you're approving tonight. The projections include 2% increases to property taxes. We're not really expecting too much to increase in federal or state revenues. As a matter of fact, state revenues will go down because we won't see any Common Core money. And our local revenues will be probably a little bit higher than they are right now. Salary and benefits are projected with retirements taken into account, 10, I believe, retirements in certificated and 10 in classified, and then also just step increases. The biggest increase here is the benefits, and that's because of health and welfare always goes up, and we're going to start seeing those big increases to STIRS and PERS going forward. So overall,
I just a couple of quick questions on the first interim. So we, when we first came into this new year, we did some purchases. Two that come out to my mind are the band uniforms and I think it was $110,000. And the truck that can see through the sewer pipes. I don't know if it's a Nikon or...
Camera?
The camera, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, the camera. Uh-huh. And so what I'm wondering is, as we look at this first interim, does this reflect those kinds of expenses already?
Yes.
So as we look at these numbers, that's already been taken out?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
So this is it's a snapshot look. And so what I'm going to be doing is, before second interim, is Julie and I will be kind of going through the budgets, looking at all those expenditures, this is where things in the expenditure column have been budgeted now. It's not necessary that we've expended everything in those funds. I mean, we have a pretty good idea in terms of personnel costs, what those are going to be, because as we run personnel, we kind of know what those budgets are going to be. But in the areas of especially materials and supplies, where a lot of site funds, there's carryover, those types of things. So we were probably about in the same spot last year at this time. And as you know, we came and we had a balanced budget basically by the end of the year. So my goal, though, is to work with Julie in terms of second interim, is to really look at all those budgets and narrow that number down. So, and then do it again, because we're going to come back to the board when we do our budget for 15-16, and we'll have another kind of almost a third interim view of where we're at currently. So what we did, as the board knows, on top of, you know, our required first interim, which we're going to ask you to act on tonight, we've also put together a 7-year kind of budget projection. And so it's nice, because for me it's a little bit more realistic. It doesn't make it look like we're hiding money somewhere, or we're saying we have a $4 million budget and we don't. And so it's kind of a good focus for us. And so Kim, if you'll put that up for me. Yeah, the 7-year, and I'll kind of, for the public's sake, and kind of go over this. So key things when we look at the 7-year, and we did the 7-year in particular because that's when the STIRS and PERS that Julie had alluded to, and our auditor alluded to, in terms of those incremental costs. There's also some key things that happen. So initially, again, we try to make this as realistic as possible. So we had, in the summertime, when the board first saw this, we had assumed a 5% increase in property taxes for 14-15. Well, things just for the board to be updated, again, Prop 30, key draw for us in 18-19, and that's basically when Prop 30 taxes are done. They're finished at that point. And then another thing that I've brought up to the board is that they're currently written in the law, and what we're finding from, you know, California Department of Education, what we're hearing from Department of Finance, is that should the LCFF be fully funded, we may lose the $3.1 million that we currently receive in LCFF state aid. So that can change. They're still in discussions. They're talking about that impact and what's going to be. Depending on how the economy goes, LCFF may be fully funded. It may not. But that's just something for the board to know. I've left it in for now. Again, hopeful it's going to be there. I will continue to watch that and that conversation. And we'll, you know, be working with you to make determinations if there is a day this year, next year, where, oh, you know what, that's... there's the possibility that may end, and then we'll have to consider that. But it's still a nice long-range view, I think, for the board. So currently, like in MA, unrestricted, we haven't received our MA funds yet. But we think we are in April, so we've went ahead and included that in this projection. Okay, so I just want to, again, trying to be as realistic as possible in terms of revenues and expenditures. So if we go down... So like for donations in particular, you know, we normally in first interim with Julie, we don't put in our donations until we receive them in first interim, second interim. But for our projections, we went ahead and put kind of an average of what those have been for the past 5 years, just to be realistic. So again, that's our total revenue. So if we go down to the next slide, it goes into our expenditures, and we've went ahead and we've put this on the board agenda so anybody can get a copy of it if they like. So we do have our new current, after we ran our salary report for October, we were able to update both our certificated, classified, and benefits. this is the part that I think I really need to work with staff and make sure that our teachers, our classified employees understand the impact of PERS and STRS on the district. So everybody's going to get, the district is going to pay 10% more per employee for STRS and PERS over the next 6 years. And you can see the total benefits costs go from $15,400,000 this year to $23 million in 2021 due to the legislation that was passed. And so that's mainly contributed to three things: STRS and PERS. Again, STRS going from $3 million contribution to $7 million. PERS, I mean, those impacts. We're currently under this projection at about 85%, 85.2% in terms of our overall personnel cost associated to our revenues. And as you know, a couple years ago when we got into trouble, we reached that 92%. Which is not a good place to be. So we really want to be mindful of our overall personnel cost in terms of our revenues. And so that's an area for us to focus, to keep focusing on. And again, you can see those costs of you know, benefits, which goes into those personnel costs, increasing. And so that was, again, a result of the legislation that was passed recently. You know, as we go down, again, I do think if you go all the way to the bottom, Kim, just so that the board knows kind of where we're at for this year, what we're anticipating is a deficit for this year of about $1 million. And a lot of that is associated to, as Julie pointed out, the Wi-Fi expenditures that were in last year's budget that are now in this year's budget in terms of expense, as well as we have to expend all of our Common Core funds by the end of this fiscal year. So that was money we received last year, but we will be spending it all. And you can see that our expenditures kind of drop the next year. And that's the reflection of those items, those material supplies, Common Core funds, you know, being expended and then not having those expenditures the following year. So we get down to more of a balanced budget approach in the 15-16 year. Now, this does not take into account employee compensation increases at all. And so those are things we need to think about, right? I mean, we know that that's, you know, part of what we'll face as a district over the next 6 years. And so as well as one-to-one computers for kids and all the different types of things that we want to implement, class size. And so those are, you know, I really feel like the seven-year projection is just a nice way for us to kind of have a realistic view. And hopefully for the public's sake, for teachers, for our staff, that they appreciate kind of the, you know, overall view of where we're at, and so that we can make the right decisions. So that's kind of a glimpse at the seven-year budget currently. Again, as we kind of go through, as we get better information, we'll continue to update that and continue to bring it back for discussion and for you to see.
Thank you. Is there anyone from the public who would like to talk to this? Okay.
Case together why we need more than a 3% reserve level for the district. In terms of the cap on basically what, you know, those reserve levels, there's a lot that has to happen prior to that being enacted by the, you know, basically by the state for us to have to follow that 3% law. Or rule, basically, and there's actually outs that we could ask the county to allow us not to do that and explain why. So I think there's going to be a lot of push this next year to see if they can adapt that trailer language a little bit and change it. But it's a great point, and it's something we're going to have to, I think, look at and really monitor over the next year. I think we're going to see some action on that behalf. But if it does stay the way it is, then we'll have to plan for it should it happen.
Mr. Unger?
Yeah, I just thank you for the seven-year projection. And I think it's interesting to really think about how difficult it is to look forward 1 or 2 years, not, you know, not just 7 years. But it really does give us some ideas about what things could look like.
Yeah.
I'm really just shocked, I guess is the best word, when I look at our benefits costs going from $14 million to $23 million by 2020, 2021. if we had, well, when we did the seven-year projection last year, we had no clue that the governor was going to propose that our STRS costs, for example, go to over 19%. This would have been a whole lot different had we known that. So as things come up, as things that we have very little control over, unfortunately, it really does change what goes on with our budget, and I think people need to be aware of that. The other thing I just wanted to make sure we clarify is when we talk about carryover funds, those are one-time monies, aren't they?
Yes.
It's not ongoing money. So when we talk about carrying things over, typically isn't it true that we have money that we have to place into different things because that's the requirement? So from year to year, we take them from certain accounts at the end of the year in June and then hold them for literally a minute or two and then move them over the next time into those more restricted funds. And then the other thing again is we have some money.
Time purchases. We have to do maintenance on classrooms. We have to do things like that. And so when those personnel expenditures get to a point where they're overcapsulating everything else, it becomes an issue. So, reserves are one time, but also I think being realistic about what our revenues, what our expenditures are going to be, what that personnel costs are, is I think for our employee groups, hopefully that's something that they tie into and can understand, right? Versus just looking at one-time funds and, hey, why don't you spend those money? Basically that personnel expenditure shows. It shows our employee groups the recognition of how much money is being put towards our employees, I would say. And then I will tell you this, too. For those LCFF districts, I've just read a couple articles recently. Those STRS and PERS increases are looking like they're going to be more than their LCFF increases. And so you're seeing districts that are, hearing that they're getting all this new money and things are great and da-da-da, when in actuality they're actually seeing their budget decline because their expenditures are going up based on the STRS, PERS increases that have been put in place. And so that's a real concern for a lot of districts right now.
I'm going to make one comment and then Mr. Millar. I just wanted to point out that I was watching Bloomberg News yesterday, and they had some people on talking about education in California and the cap on reserves, and everyone was talking about how irresponsible that was, that it was a big problem and shouldn't be an issue that districts should have to worry about. That it's irresponsible to require districts to bring their reserves down.
Well, every time I see an article in the Tribune or on the media about Diablo Canyon and closing it down and those types of things, and the impact that could have on our district would
be huge.
A big reason why we need to have greater reserves than the 3%.
Right. That's right, Mr. Millar.
Well, I'd say that's one of the advantages that we have when they change funding formulas and things like that. We always know we're not going to get any new money.
Yeah.
So that's a comfort of sorts. I move Resolution 051415, positive certificate of adequate funding by the Board of Education.
I'll second it.
All right. We have a motion and a second. Mr. Millar and Mr. Quisenberry, any further discussion? Okay, this is a roll call vote, Mrs. Holmes.
I mean, Measure D has kind of taken over our lives, Anthony and I in particular, and just thinking and planning and doing all these things. And at some points I stop and I just, okay, it's only been a month, right? We haven't, not everything's been constructed yet, or we haven't moved forward. So that said, we're making great progress. Something happened about a week and a half ago, and that is Dr. Prater received a call from the president of Cuesta College to talk about renovations and things that were happening on their campus. And one of those was closing the Cuesta pool. And so that kind of changed our course a little bit, because our plan was to come forward with the board, and Anthony's going to talk to you a little bit about that, with plans to move forward with Morro Bay High School, San Luis High School, big design plans. And with the closing of the Morro Bay, or of Cuesta College's pool, which Morro Bay High School uses, we really felt like for the kids, for the school, that we should begin to move on that project and kind of separate that from the overall design phase planning that Anthony's going to talk to you about for both schools. And so tonight, Anthony's going to walk you through kind of what we're asking the board to do to get that project in particular established. We had Morro Bay staff, myself, Anthony, some members of the community that went out and looked at a few different pools, designs, and input. San Luis High and their staff are going out tomorrow to do the same and visit some different pools and get conversations to talk about design and what these designs should be, because we want to integrate those two together. So I'm going to have Anthony kind of talk about where we're headed next.
Okay. Good evening. The first of probably many times you'll see me over the next 5 to 7 years. We're here to talk a little bit about sort of the steps we're taking to kickstart the Morro Bay High School pool, and then some of the steps that we're going to put in place to get both Morro Bay and San Luis Obispo High School, the remainder of the projects on those two campuses, going early next year in the planning process. So we'll go ahead and go to the first slide there. And Mr. Pinkerton kind of gave a little bit of background on kind of what's prompting this in terms of the closure of the Cuesta pool. And so we've engaged KBZ Architects to put a proposal together to start the planning process for the Morro Bay High School pool, with the idea that the actual pool design itself, which is kind of the soils at each site, so you're going to have different utility configurations at each site. It's different things that we'll have to change on the pool technical design, but the basic pool template, if you will, depth, configuration, gutter type, etc., will be the same at both sites. Okay. And so, you know, the idea will be that early this year we'll start the actual design of the Morro Bay pool, with the idea that that's the template for the San Luis High pool as well. Then we'll start to begin actual technical construction document design in the spring of next year, get it submitted to the Division of the State Architect later this year, and be ready to start construction hopefully in early of 2016. So just a little context again, this is the Morro Bay High School master plan. Again, this is the full wants concept, but this is that location that we're talking about for the pool. The nice thing and the way we're able to kind of separate this project out from the campus as a whole is that this is really an underutilized piece of property right now. We have three relocatables that we've got plenty of time to get moved into empty spaces that are within the campus as a whole, and while we're displacing them, we're not displacing someone else to do that. We've got a lot of room at this campus classroom-wise. And then at the same time, we're going to be starting to focus in on some of the preliminary work for that student center out front, because there's some economies of scale as some of these engineers are out there working. Let's go ahead and get them started. And we'll talk a little bit more about the thinking behind that. So this is the layout of what the Morro Bay pool will conceptually look like. Give you a little blow up here, and then that student center. And again, this is very conceptual. This is not necessarily what it will lay out on the site like, but this is the general vicinity of where it will be. So move forward. So kind of a timeline of what's going on. We're bringing forward tonight a couple of contracts that'll kickstart the process. And those are some of the initial phases or the services for this first phase of work that we need to get going. We'll start some meetings next week with the users of both sites, if we can get everything scheduled in that timeline. If not, before the end of the year, we'd like to have that first meeting out of the way and behind us, if you will. Early next year, we'll begin the coastal development application process through the city of Morro Bay. That's our coastal commission, essentially. And then we'll start some planning meetings early next year to develop that template and develop that concept design for the pool that will, for both sites, in terms of that. It's kind of a best case scenario, and I'm trying to be very optimistic here. The architect in me and the eternal optimist in me has got this set, but we're still really, there's a long way to go to kind of confirm this up. But our goal is to minimize the time that the Morro Bay aquatics team is out without a pool. So the architect in me started down this path to get that pool at Morro Bay High School moving, with the idea of getting the concept for the slow high pool moving as well, to get them ahead of the game. But then the facilities director in me is also engaged with Mr. Pinkerton, Cal Poly, for potential use of their pools for the Morro Bay High School team. because the last thing we want to do is try and pack both Morro Bay and San Luis in the Sinchheimer pool. It's just going to be a difficult situation. So Cal Poly's been very receptive, and they're working through some of the details on their side to see what kind of time they can give us there. So the facility side of me is kind of working that angle of it, too, to make sure that the students in a year from now have a pool to use. Okay? So we'll go ahead to the next slide. So then what's going on bigger picture for both of the campuses? At this point, we're starting to engage two architects for both the Morro Bay High School and the San Luis High School. We're talking to KBZ about doing the overall planning and concept design for the campus at Morro Bay. We're talking to PMSM Architects about an overall campus planning and design for San Luis Obispo High School. We'll be bringing some contracts forward to you in January to begin that planning process, and that'll initiate a dialogue with the site facilities committees at each of those campuses to kind of really start to hone in on what we're going to really do out at each of those sites and develop that more finite scope of work in terms of, you know, what are we doing in Building 100? What are we doing in Building 500? What are we doing for a pool at San Luis High? What are we doing for the new gym and the old gym? What are we really drilling down into some of the technical aspects of that and developing a budget and a scope? At that point, mid-year next year, the plan is to kind of bring back a more defined budget and scope with some concept designs and some budgeting and some prioritization that we're working with that site committee, and then bring back some more additional contracts to move into the construction document phase for submittal to the DSA for final plan approval and start construction of the major projects. Again, best case scenario I would see right now is the way the calendaring is starting to work out, that the first big shovels in the ground for the major construction projects at both high schools, aside from the Morro Bay pool and maybe some other auxiliary projects at each of the sites, would probably begin in June of 16. Okay. And so then again, just kind of a reminder to get some space freed up so that then we can really start renovating some of the existing spaces on campus. Again, the idea is to start building square footage that's permanent and move people into it and get them settled, as opposed to building temporary housing all over and moving people around multiple times. So that's kind of the concept there. So there's four contracts on tonight's board. There's the first contract is KBZ Architects.
I just want to tie in really quick with the master plan and talking about, for instance, at San Luis High in particular, and the reason why we don't jumpstart the pool there is they have a whole different, you know, question about classroom space there. And where are the portables going to go on that campus during construction? How is that going to be? In talking to the site committee, they've already talked about possibly moving the pool to the baseball diamond and rearranging where softball's at and the baseball. So these are the site kind of getting that site committee together, getting those conversations going, why it's so important to get those, you know, get those groups together and talking about something like that with the whole design of the campus and the flow of projects and what's going to happen, why that's so important. At the same time, like Anthony said, we are getting the San Luis High, they have a fantastic swim coach there that knows a lot about pools and has a lot of interest and a lot of ideas. And so we want Morro Bay to share in that knowledge. And so kind of working with all of the groups together will hopefully help us with that design aspect. And so those are positive things. At the spot in particular at Morro Bay High School, that's one where it's set, you know, from the site committee, in talking to everyone there, that's the best place to locate it. So Mrs. Andrade. Sorry. Go ahead. I just wanted to talk about that before we got into the contracts.
First of all, who's bidding our contracts with the various vendors?
These are the contract templates that were provided to us by Lozano Smith.
Okay.
So these are the model year 13-14 contract templates. Okay.
They had that feel to them, even though I confess I did not read them in detail. And I'm assuming, and maybe I shouldn't do that, but a couple of the contracts for the above ground engineering and geotechnical engineering reports are fairly low cost items. So does that communicate that we're not expecting any surprises?
So let's have Anthony. So that was, I interrupted him before he was going to go through each of the contracts, what they mean, what they were. So I'll let him. Why don't you go ahead?
Great engineering, just the topographic information for the pool area, as well as that student services building, because we'll need some information there for some other things we're doing. And while they're out there, we might as well have them do both. We need to do that eventually anyway, so let's get them. You know, it's just a few bucks more to have them do it. We're going to have to do it eventually. So, again, trying to strike while the iron's hot. So the contract's in front of you. Did that answer the question? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Okay. And then I'm sorry.
Yeah, Ms. Kett.
Back to the pool just for a moment. I did ask Mr. Pinkerton about this. So the fact that we're perhaps entering into contracts about designing a pool doesn't preclude the possibility of a Martha pool, the kind that would be already constructed that we would place on one of our campuses?
Yeah, this is really the template for the pool at this point at each of the sites. So again, if you can kind of think of it as a kitchen sink cabinet, okay, and it's going to have some different things for the different kitchens you might put it in, but for the most part, we're designing 36-inch wide kitchen sink with two doors, and it's made out of wood, and that's kind of our standard that we're doing, and then we might have to move the plumbing at one kitchen versus at a different kitchen. The plumbing comes in from this side, et cetera. So if you kind of think of it as that, it's we're designing that template, and then, you know, and I've already spoken with Aquatic Design Group, that there's some goods and bads of a, and I don't want to use the term MRF, I want to use a stainless steel pool is probably the better term. It's kind of like Kleenex. It becomes the name, but there are different manufacturers. But, you know, it doesn't lend itself well to an ocean environment is what our consultants are telling us right now. So it may not work for Morro Bay, but it may work for San Luis. And there's upsides and downsides to both. And I want to really rely on Aquatic Design Group to educate us on the pros and cons of each for the two different sites. And so does that kind of...
Yes, no, that's okay. Fine. I just want to make sure we're leaving that possibility.
Yeah, no. You know, this is really sort of, you know, the pool will be 25 by 35 with this type of gutter, with, you know, this color lane line, with, you know, this depth and at this various locations. And, you know, if we did it in plaster, it'd look like this. If we did it in stainless steel, it'd look like this. And here's, and then, you know, which one are we going to apply at each site? And then we'd move forward at a future date with that final determination and technical development of drawings.
Along with cost,
yeah.
Thanks. Mr. Unger.
Yeah, I just want to say that the fact that we're the unfortunate closure of the Cuesta pool, that's one of those opportunities that will help us move forward on the pool in the bay. I know this is
a consultant that we'll be working with and that will be basically helping to develop the design project, if you will, for the concept and the template of the pool as a whole, as well as then getting it how it's going to, you know, conceptually fit on the site, where the plumbing, utilities, etc., will happen for the Morro Bay campus. They will have a host of consulting engineers that will help them with that design process, if you will, including Aquatic Design Group, who's an internationally known aquatics consultant, and several of our local engineering firms here in town that have worked for the district many years. So they'll be, that's the lead consultant that's working with us on that first phase of the design. And their fees are in accordance with our standard fee schedule that's in our contract templates from Lozano Smith. Some of the parts and pieces of information that they will need, the first few things out the gate that they need are the site topographic study, so the boundary of the site, the elevations of the various pieces on the site, where the trees are, where utilities underground are, where cleanouts are for sewers, etc., and just what is the site layout. And they have to do that work first. And Above Grade Engineering is also the civil engineer that's working for KBZ Architects, so it's a real nice marriage, and they're a local firm here in town. So it's a nice marriage that they're actually doing both. So they've already got to jump on their work from the engineering side by being out there and kind of looking at the site topography. Earth system specific is that second piece of data that the design team will need, which is basically our soils analysis, for lack of a better term. They're telling us what kind of dirt we have down there, where our water table is, what kind of parameters we're going to be faced with for the design, the structural design of the pool itself, and any outbuildings that we may have. In addition, they have to do an evaluation of any local faults and proximity to local faults and potential activity of local faults, and give a seismic factor, if you will, for how we will design the buildings structurally. And then the third component is a little less tied to the architect, but will down the line kind of have a tie to the architect, which is Firma Consultants, who's doing our coastal development permit, and they're a local firm here in town as well. and they have they were involved in a lot of coastal development permits through at Morro Bay throughout the years, and they were actually the latest development permit they did was for the solar arrays that are out there. And so they were heavily involved in that project, and we've actually already scheduled a pre-application meeting with the city. We had that last week. We're already starting to get our paperwork put together.
Thank you. Mrs. Roger.
Thank you. Yeah, I got that look on my face, but does Firma, does the city of Morro Bay function as sort of the representative body of the Coastal Commission so that when Firma makes application to them and it's approved, is that in lieu of going to the Coastal Commission itself? Or are we still having to submit to Coastal Commission on Morro Bay?
No, that's a very good question. The city of Morro Bay will act as our Coastal Commission permitting agency, okay, assuming no appeals or any major issues that pop up through that process. So, you know, again, unless we find something major that's unmitigatable and it has to go up to the commission, or there's an appeal to the project.
Okay, and then so, my other question, just really quickly, the group from Morro Bay High School, or representing Morro Bay High School, has already done their tour of several pool facilities in the area. And San Luis will be doing theirs tomorrow.
Yes.
So then are they going to put their heads together, the two groups, and come up with what, you know, might be considered to be our standard specification, even though we only have two pools, but we would call it our district standard? And what if they don't agree on what they, if they have different opinions of what is the best pool to go for? We have some financial criteria that will kind of dictate, you know, some of it. But when the Morro Bay people got back, did they have a pool that they saw that they thought, this is great, this is what we'd really like to see? Did we get any feedback?
I think they were pretty happy with any hole in the ground that they could swim in, to be honest with you. No, I mean, there was definitely some things we talked about. I wouldn't say that they said, that's our pool. They said, we like this piece of Pioneer Valley, we like this piece of AG, we like the lighting here. They've talked about some other pools that they've seen that we can bring some that we didn't go see that day, but they've seen in the past. So I think it was a very good activity in the fact that they got to see a few things and talk to the people that are actually using those pools right now. And some things that you would think, oh, that's a great idea, like flush gutters. The coaches, you know, the coach at Rio Grande is like, I don't like the flush gutter because my feet get wet the whole time, so I stand in water all the time, as opposed to the probably have to bring it up to the next level in terms of, all right, let's really look at this and what is the cost impacts, and then, you know, making the decisions.
I have no doubt that we can build consensus.
Yeah, okay. I'm pretty confident. You go the last few slides. Yeah, just scroll all the way to the bottom. So if you look here, this is what they call, right? Yep, stop right there. This is a flush gutter. That water is basically right at the same level as that gutter system. So the water spills over and goes into a gutter that runs along the perimeter of this pool. Okay? This is basically a underdeck gutter. So this water spills over into a gutter underneath this deck, and the coach sits about 12 inches up out of the water. Being a swimmer myself, this is tougher to get out of as an old man trying to get out of a pool after swimming a couple miles.
But so would that be the purpose of a flush gutter then, is for ease of exiting the pool? Or it, what is the purpose?
It's kind of just a cleaner feature in terms of it's just flush, and like for PE purposes, they just kind of walk into it as opposed to actually having to jump a foot. For young, newer swimmers, people that aren't as experienced in the water, this can be a little more daunting. This is a little less daunting. But okay, you can account for that by having a much more generous entry and spend a little money here instead of a lot of money all the way around the pool, if that makes sense.
So would you say that it's primarily aesthetics?
No, there's some functional things to it in terms of just having it. This starts to, you know, there's, in terms of putting the lane lines in and other things, you've got this gutter back in here. There's some convenience things to having it this way,
okay,
and some functionality.
Senior swimmers need the easy in and out.
Yeah. Guilty.
Okay. Well, both those pools look great to me. Then my last question just has to do with, and either you and I discussed it or Mr. Pinkerton and I discussed it, but there was some discussion I had at some point about, at least on the coast, we have to be conscious of artifacts and what have you. And would we be contracting with, it would be the Chumash, somebody from the Chumash tribe to come, or would Firma contract with them? Or how would that work?
Very nicely done. So we had our pre-application meeting, and we really went in with the focus of coastal development permit. And as between the date, what we may have there in terms of resources, to come back with another proposal to kind of go down that path as well. So that's kind of the thing we'll probably see early next year.
But it would be Firma that would be
handling
that. Yeah,
we've asked them. They've been handling that for most of the things out there on that site for the last few years. So it makes sense to bring them in and kind of be the lead for those other groups that would do that. So, yeah, thank you. That was a very good question.
Thank you.
Okay, anyone from the public who would like to speak on this? Okay, then I'll bring it back to the board. We have a motion made by Mr. Unger to approve. How do you want to word that? To approve proceeding on the Morro Bay High School pool project, is that correct?
Agreements, yeah.
The agreements? Mr. Unger, am I... Yeah,
you have a suggested motion in your board docs item that specifies four separate contracts and their purposes and dollar amounts.
So do we need to approve each one individually, or can we approve them
as a
group?
You can do a single motion to approve all four.
Okay. And we need a second.
I will second it if that's Mr. Unger's intention to approve all four.
Yes.
I second it.
Any further discussion? We have a motion by Mr. Unger, second by Mr. Quesenberry. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed or abstentions? Thank you. Motion carries.
We're off to the races.
Thank you, Mr. Palazzo.
Thank you very much.
We'll look forward to spending more time with you. Okay, next, item 10.02, elementary reading and writing. I see Mrs. Shields.
Good evening.
Thank you.
I think I remember why I'm here. Tonight we are here to provide you an update on the first trimester elementary or K-6 common assessments in both reading and in writing. Our instructional services teacher on special assignment for elementary assessment, Darla Batistic, will be presenting to you. We're going to be looking at the benchmark assessment system K-2 reading assessment that was given to all of our students kindergarten through second grade at the end of the first trimester. We're also going to be looking at the SRI, the Scholastic Reading Inventory, which is an online computer-adapted assessment that all of our students in third through sixth grade take three times a year. And then finally, we're going to round it up with looking at our narrative writing
in format. And I'm going to keep the data short and sweet tonight because I'd say just first of all, this is our beginning of year data. This is from assessments that students took at the end of November. We look at it as a starting place. So when we're looking at our data, we're looking at students who have already met end-of-year proficiency by November. It's a starting point, and we have all year to work on this. So when you're looking at the data and you're seeing low numbers of proficiency, it's the beginning of the year. So keep that in mind as we look. And then I will be back in June to wrap this data back around to say, hey, here's where we were in November, and now here's where we are in June. So that's coming. That will be coming your way. Starting with the BAS data, you'll see that at this point of the year, we have about 24% of our students who have already met the end of year proficiency, another 55% in our district of K-2 students who are on target to meet proficiency by the end of the year. And then that same information is broken down by grade level in this slide, kinder, first, and second grade. We don't identify kindergarten students at risk in this kind of a data presentation at the beginning of the year because they're emerging readers. So to not be, you're on target at this point. However, Our kindergarten teachers know they have at-risk students in their classroom, and many of those students are already participating in early intervention, such as LLI and classroom interventions. What I would want to point out on that slide for our K-2 readers is that we do still have at-risk readers. If you look at the district number, about 21% of our students right now are at risk at not meeting end-of-year proficiency. And so interventions such as LLI that I just mentioned and reading recovery are designed to meet the needs of those students in that at-risk category. This is a slide that I shared with you, or this data I shared with you in the packet last Friday. Something that we took from here and moved to the next slide is a look at specific populations. So the discussion earlier that Dr. Crocker shared with you about the LCAP and the funding that goes along with it, there are a couple of specific populations that are called out in our plans to take a look at and to work with funding and action plans in increasing their reading and math proficiency. Tonight it's about reading. So this is what the data looks like. Again, that 24% up at the top is carried from that first slide. And it is less so in third grade, where they're taking that assessment for the first time. And we know our third graders, the more times they take that computer adaptive assessment, the more accurate it is for him, for them. Again, if we look across third through sixth grade, we do still see some at-risk readers. That would be the orange area of your graph, and intervention is still needed for some of our fragile readers in upper grade. We looked at that data again for our specific populations, carrying that 53% over to this slide, and then comparing that to how our students are doing that are socioeconomically disadvantaged or English learners. So you'll note a big discrepancy for our English learners in this area, and we attribute that to a couple of things. One, the SRI is a really independent assessment. It's not supported like the BAS you might have seen in the data in the last slides for K-2. But also, this assessment and reading and writing in general are so dependent on vocabulary, and that being able to read to learn, that our English learners really need a lot of work in developing that vocabulary, reading vocabulary and academic vocabulary, in order to demonstrate proficiency in reading when they get to that level. So those students that are at risk that we were looking at in our other data would then possibly be assessed with the BAS, which is actually a diagnostic tool that would tell teachers more about their actual reading behaviors and how to teach into their strengths and develop their weaknesses in reading. And I'll share that data also with you the next time I meet with you. The last piece of data, as Mrs. Shields mentioned, is our data from our narrative on-demand writing assessment. So you know we've implemented a new writing curriculum last year, and we're in our second year of implementation. So we're very curious to look at this data and say, how are our students doing? And it is, again, the beginning of the year. So the student proficiency is low to start with. It was very low last year, and I'm going to show you some information about that in our first year of implementation. This curriculum is rigorous. Our teachers are learning how to teach it, and our students, I'm happy to say, are becoming writers. If we look at this same information with our specific populations, you'll see it follows the same trend that our socioeconomically disadvantaged and English learner students. And this is an opportunity where I can share with you side-by-side data of the same assessment given at the same time of year and how those scores are shifting in our second year. So if you look at the orange bars, I just put them side-by-side last year, and this year is green. If you look at the orange bars, when I looked at this data, I said, wow, look, a majority and the bulk of our scores are really in that 1, 1.5, 2 range. This year, by contrast, the bulk of our scores are really in the 2 and 2.5 range. And so what we're seeing is a shift of students as they are growing up through the writing curriculum. Now they're in their second year of instruction in this area. We're seeing a lot of growth in the proficiency. We're nudging towards proficiency. That's what we like to call that. So that I found to be extremely exciting news. And I'd like to, and that, that's the data that we have to share tonight for English language arts, both in reading and in writing. But I wanted to spend a couple of minutes sharing with you, what does it look like in year two of implementation of a curriculum? You've probably heard about our curriculum, our Lucy Calkins Units of Study and Writing. It's a rigorous curriculum. It requires a lot of our teachers. Teachers have been working really hard, both last year and into this year, on learning how to teach Common Core aligned, rigorous standards. And they've had to do a lot of work in order to understand the curriculum and teach it at a high level. And so what does it look like in year two when we've implemented the units? So here's a little short video to kind of see how are things going in the classroom. In our second year of implementation of the Lucy Calkins Units of Study and Writing, elementary students are writing with more stamina and proficiency. Teachers are developing efficacy with the new curriculum and noticing the change in student writers in their classrooms.
Well, I think the writing is going a lot easier this year compared to last year. The students are more focused, they have much more perseverance, they're much more willing to engage, and they come in with a background knowledge already of personal narrative.
Explains second grade teacher Kimberly Dimbat from Hawthorne Elementary. The 6th through 8th grade units were released last spring and are now in every 6th grade classroom at Criders. Hawthorne 1st grade teacher Julie Dye had an interesting experience this fall that gave her a glimpse of how writing has changed in her classroom.
I got a new student from out of the area, and we were doing writer's workshop, and she was having a difficult time putting words down on paper. She kept asking, what should I say next? And how do you spell this word? And as I was noticing, the rest of my classroom was working. So I thought about it and said, I am so impressed with this writing program that we have here in San Luis Coastal.
In the program, student writers choose their own topics within the writing type that they are studying. Student Anya O'Toole from Los Osos Middle School recently wrote a narrative about diving with the manta rays.
This was it. I was going down. Made some final checks with my gear and stepped off the boat. I eventually swam over to everyone else and got ready to descend down the rope, which led to the ocean floor. Moon was in the sky as I climbed down the rope. Night was when the manta rays came out. We followed the dive masters where we would attract some of the smallest creatures in the sea to become food for the huge manta rays. The snorkelers above, hanging on to an...
She explains why she chose her narrative topic.
Right about the manta ray dive because I thought it was really cool and I didn't think anybody else in the class had done it before.
Students are excited about their self-selected writing topics. Specific lessons help students develop a variety of writing skills. They learn how to structure, develop, and revise their writing. From effective leads like this one written by Hawthorne third grade writer Owen Hacker.
Creek, I opened the garage to find my shiny bike sitting there waiting. I found my helmet and popped it on. I slowly rolled my bike out of the garage. I was excited because it was my first time going all the way down my very big driveway on my bike. My destination was at the bottom of the driveway.
And endings that wrap around to show why a particular piece of writing is significant.
My x-ray and looked at it very closely. Then she announced, it's broken all right. I said, can I have an orange cast? She said, sure. A few minutes later, I had a bright orange cast. As I walked out of the room, I strutted into the parking lot so everybody could see my bright orange cast. To this day, I remember how I broke my arm.
Even kindergarten students like Elise Corey from Los Ranchos are writing complete narratives with a beginning, middle, and end.
Setting and character, plot and theme, and then we would parallel that, all of the information we were learning, to what we were writing.
At our October writing scoring professional development, teachers took a moment to reflect on the shifts they've seen in their young writers, giving a shout out to the grade level teachers before them. Overwhelmingly, teachers noted the increase in stamina elementary writers now exhibit. Philip Roski explains the difference he sees in his first graders at Del Mar.
Just volume. They can write a ton, and they love to write. Just the love for writing, I think.
As a unit of writing wraps up, students work to revise and edit and publish a final piece of writing. Mark Riley shares that by writing with his students and sharing his process, he can model what writers do.
I'm spending a lot of my time in class writing with my students and sharing my writing with them, talking about what I could do better, and trying to give concrete examples to them of what a writer does and how a writer can actually never be finished. There's always room for improvement. So we're really looking at writing as a long-term skill that's developed slowly with a lot of input from each other.
Writing is celebrated in classrooms across the district at publishing parties, where student work is shared with classmates, parents, and guests. But as Mark Riley shared, a writer's job, like a teacher's job, is never done. And so elementary students are on to the next writing type and new topics.
I'm writing on an informational textbook on baseball. And so far, I have a lot of three chapters. And my introduction and my last chapter, my chapter that I'm writing right now is on how to throw a curveball.
So now I'm working on a persuasive argument, writing for the story of the Emperor's New Clothes.
And so we are writers. But the real power of an articulated, rigorous writing program is explained by Janice Brown.
The great thing about writing is that the kids came into third grade thinking of themselves as writers.
So I hope that gives you a glimpse at the work that's going on in our classrooms and the exciting times as writing shifts in our school district.
Really thank is. You. Thank you. Anyone from the public?
On the SRI for third through sixth grade, my notes as you presented were, how are we intervening for EL students that are struggling? We have reading recovery, first grade, LLI, continuing on into second grade. But for students in three through six, how are we intervening for those kids? And then also, how do we assist in building vocab for EL students?
Well, the EL question is pretty complicated because we have EL students who are level ones and twos who are beginners, and we also have EL students who are level three, fours, and on towards becoming proficient in English. We're lucky in this district that we have budgeted EL specialists or a portion thereof at each of our school site that either do pull out or push in EL direct support for our students, and that is there's a direct correlation with that support because it does have a reading, writing, and language focus that will help these children. We also, thanks to the board bringing this back last year, have a summer school program where we target our English learners. So these students receive 20 more half days of instruction targeted in reading, writing, and math. So those are the two first things. The intervention LLI is available to all students, and I can tell you we have a number of English learners. Once they reach that level of English proficiency where they can gain from an LLI lesson or a series of lessons, that they can access that as well.
So they could be accessing that in fourth, fifth, or sixth grade if they needed to?
It's pretty rare to see it up in sixth grade, but certainly fourth grade up to fifth grade potentially.
Okay, so writing being so vocabulary dependent, mm-hmm. What you're saying, Mrs. Shields, then is just more exposure?
Well, with English learners, what the research says to us is that they need time. They also need, you know, direct instruction. They need practice. They need engaged time, having meaningful dialogue. They need to be practicing their writing. So, but the time piece is a piece of it. I've got to give a little shout out to our after-school buses as well, and intervention programs that take place for some of our students, including some of our English learners as well. I forgot that part. Thanks to that being part of our LCAP plan this year. Because they need more than their counterpart sitting next to them that speaks English as their first language.
Well, as they get to just follow along all the way through, and I would think that would inject another level of agility on the part of the teacher to need to deal with new incoming students at various grades who haven't been exposed to this.
I would certainly agree, and I think Mrs. Dye made a great point in saying that students coming in new to our system that haven't been part of really two and a half years of Writers' Workshop are identifying themselves as kids that we need to pay some attention to right away. But one of the beauties of Writers' Workshop is that the kids support each other. If you've got kids in that first grade class that are busy writing, and you've got one kiddo who's brand new to the game saying, I don't know what to do, well, now you've got the teacher, because you've developed these independent workers, that's able to bring that kiddo along and support him or her catch up with the rest of the group.
Thank you. Mr. Pleasantberry.
This is more in line of perhaps observations, and maybe there's a question in there too to respond to. I've been very impressed with the things I've seen, especially primary students bringing home little books to home to read, and they're writing home to read to share with their parents or their brothers and sisters. My question kind of goes to a program that I've seen in the preschool, the Raising a Reader, and then making an observation that seems like a wonderful program. I know that we have it in some of our schools, but my question really, or my observation, has to deal with what is it that we're doing to encourage more reading materials in terms of books, magazines, and so forth, getting into the homes of the kids that don't get those things necessarily, don't necessarily have a local library card and so forth?
Great question. What pops to my mind, one of the things that we're piloting this year is the MyOn online reading program. We're piloting that at three of our Title I schools, and a fourth one's going to join in January. And this is a over 4,000, somewhere between 4,000 and 5,000 online books that are accessible to students with an account. Now, if I don't have an online account at home, that is a deterrent. So I want to acknowledge that. But for many, many of our children, this access to this account can offer them. At Smith, we used to do a books on tape, that we'd have a CD and a set of books, and that we'd do kind of roving those around so that they would get home to families who otherwise might not have access to those. I think we probably have sites that are doing that now, but I can't speak to that specifically. I agree with you, the Raising a Reader program is a phenomenal way that we have put books in the hands of children in all of our Success for All preschools, as well as we added it this year at the Del Mar Transitional Kindergarten program, where they are taking home books weekly. Some of the books are bilingual. They're very parent friendly. The parents attend a training where they learn how to support their child, whether they speak English or not, in developing that love of literacy.
Thank you very much. Thanks. Okay, item 10.03 has to do with increasing the long-term sub pay rate. Ms. Newland.
That was a great presentation. Hats off to Darla and Amy and the teachers of San Luis Coastal. I have to say, as a young professional 25 years ago, I was involved in the Kern Eastern Sierra Writing Project and spent a year doing action research on Writers' Workshop and wrote a book with a group of people on that topic. But at the time, I was one of a few, you know, very few number of professionals looking into it. And to see the implementation across the district is really, really impressive. So turning to a little more black and white topic, and that would be the topic of long-term subpay. Every year, the HR professionals in this county gather data on salaries and look at wages. And you may or may not know, but substitutes has been a big topic across all of our schools, not only in our county, but really across the nation, because as the economy has gotten better, the sub pools have become depleted as people have gotten jobs, and so there's a lot of competition right now for substitutes. In cabinet, we looked at both our regular rate of pay and our long-term substitute rate of pay. And in analyzing our regular day-to-day rate of pay, there's only two districts that pay, you know, more than $100 a day, which is what we pay, and that would be Shandon, which is very rural, and the County Office of Education, which is trying to attract those teachers with specialized credentials. So we felt like in the area of a day-to-day substitute, we are competitive. We have Templeton paying $150. So we thought just to be a little bit more competitive, and with the increase with Common Core and the increase in responsibilities, we felt that it was warranted to move our long-term sub rate up from $120 to $130. So that would be our recommendation.
Okay. Anyone from the public here to talk about this item? Seeing none, Mrs. Roger, then Mr. Unger.
Okay. With regard to this item, I feel that that increasing it from $120 to $130 a day doesn't really dignify the expectations that we have of a long-term sub. A substitute comes in for one day or 2 days. If the class doesn't move forward, there's really no huge loss because the classroom teacher can pick up and run when they get back. But a sub that's in the classroom for 30 days, 45 days, 60 days is really entrusted with moving the education of those students forward. And if they're there that long, they're interacting with parents, participating in IEPs, I would assume, and really taking on the full responsibilities of a classroom teacher for that length of time. And I know in our district that what we endeavor to do is to pay our teachers the best possible wages that we can. We're at the top with our teachers, we're at the top with our classifieds, we're at the top with our administrators. And I think that given the responsibilities of a long-term sub, even though taking them to $130 a day may put us on par with many of the districts around us, I think that it doesn't speak to the value that we place on their work. So I would be willing to go to $140 a day for myself. If you had 10 long-term subs in a given year, which would be of those substitutes, and I would really like to see us compensate them. That's my feeling to my colleagues.
I have a question regarding our long-term sub pay. Do we do differential pay for the substitute and the teacher for whom the substitute is working for? So in other words, if the regular teacher in the classroom is making $300 a day, and they do go out for what we would consider long term, typically, my understanding, at least where I used to work, there was a differential. And so the long-term sub would make whatever the long-term sub makes, and then that would be subtracted from the amount of money that the teacher would make. So the teacher, instead of making $300 a day, would make $160 a day. Is that how we do it here?
Yes. So first, the person has to exhaust their sick leave. So if they have a big bank of sick leave, which I'm always advocating for people, don't burn your sick leave unless you really need to burn your sick leave. A lot of people don't understand that concept. But a lot of our long-term teachers will have large sick leave balances, which is a great benefit when if they were to get ill. But if you have a newer teacher that doesn't have that bank of sick leave, they're going to run out of that sick leave sooner. And yes, then they go into differential, and that's subtracted the amount that the substitute would make. So you are correct that that would offset that.
Thank you.
Well, with all due respect to my friend and colleague, I thought we attempted to provide competitive, attractive total compensation. So I'm always nervous when we start talking about honoring work through the amount of money we pay. It's very elusive concept for me. I have no problem with increasing to $130 a day. I didn't follow that entire discussion, but I'm not sure that's germane to the decision right now. So how does $130 a day compare with, say, let's say an elementary teacher? You may not be able to figure this out.
Yeah, an elementary teacher or any teacher on the first cell of the salary schedule makes $230 a day.
Okay, so, and that would be...
They're $300, and they would only be getting $150.
So any largesse for the long-term sub could have the consequence of decreasing
correct.
Income for...
if they run out of sick leave, that is
teacher.
True.
And thank you, and I'm glad I understand that a little better now, and I think it's important. I mean, it's almost, avoiding unintended consequences. I don't know that we need to be bidding against ourselves when, staff brings us a salary adjustment recommendation, but, I support the recommendation.
Mrs. Roger.
Well, I would say that a recommendation is just that, and that it's our decision to make. And, Mr. Millar, I would agree with you that we endeavor to provide total compensation packages, but I would ask you to remember that this $130 or $140 is total compensation because these are unbenefited workers.
I was making a comment regarding your statement about our goal in paying people to honor their work.
Mr. Unger, then Mr. Quisenberry.
I'm not opposed to increasing the per diem for our long-term substitutes because I think Mrs. Roger is right that these are people with whom we have tasked a great deal of responsibility. I guess a question I have because I'm uncomfortable with the board, Marilyn. I'm uncomfortable with the board suggesting a price. And I'd like to have this go back to the administration for a relook and make a determination whether where did $130 come from, and is that just because we thought, well, $130 sounds good. We know there's some getting more. We know there's some getting less. So we'll choose $130. Or was there a really rational decision made that, and I'm not accusing anybody of irrationality, but was there a decision made that $130 will really help us achieve our goals and will get us the kind of people we want? I'd be curious.
Well, I have much to respond to. I fully appreciate Mrs. Rogers' observation that it's good to compensate people well, and that this possibly is not enough. But I also find that Mr. Unger's points are also worth considering. I think the question for me or the is this enough to attract, you know, the kind of substitute, long-term substitute that we need, that will you know, continue the progress that's being made by the teacher that's on leave for whatever reason. And so I would concur with you, Mr. Unger. I'd like the administration to come back with this again after some consideration. But you just said that you had talked with the cabinet. And are we experiencing difficulty finding?
Well, currently we
subs?
Only have one long-term sub.
So one, and yeah.
So yes, we selected the sub. Actually, we had an outstanding candidate that we did not have enough positions for at the beginning of the year for an elementary teaching, and we asked her if she would pick up a long-term sub that we knew was coming up in November. So we have one. We have two more coming up in the spring. Typically, we're able to fill them with student teachers that are finishing their student teachers or people who want into our district, because it's a very desirable district to be in, so people want to get a leg into our district. And so typically with the small numbers that we're trying to attract, we're able to find that.
Is there a time also that let's say you have a long-term sub for the end of the first semester and they go beyond the 20 days, and then the teacher who's on leave for whatever reason is unable to come back to the for the second semester? Do they go on a salary schedule at that point if they're going to cover for an entire semester, or they still stay on the long-term sub?
If the teacher goes out on leave, for example, asks for a more permanent leave, then we'll put them on a temporary contract against their leave, and then they'll be moved on to the $230, you know, if they're on the first cell, and they'll be eligible for benefits at that point in time if they're working full-time. Or somebody who's on leave for a year, and we've filled it with a temporary teacher, that's a different
term sub, because having been in this situation before where my child had a teacher that we're quite happy with and then the teacher's leaving on a long-term illness or pregnancy, as a parent, you want a teacher as a replacement who's of the same caliber as the teacher who is taking the leave. And I understand that, you know, we may need to pay more for that kind of talent. So we'd just like to have you perhaps consider that as we're as we're looking at this, not strictly as an economic issue, but about how it suits the children and that gap of time that they're not going to be having their primary teacher.
So it sounds as though the board's wishes that perhaps more information be gathered and brought back to us before taking action. Is that correct, or do we want to take action tonight, Dr. Prater?
Yeah, I would be happy to re-engage a discussion at cabinet, and maybe we spent a good hour in cabinet talking about this topic alone, and we
Is that a long time?
Yeah, we had quite the engaging conversation for a number of the reasons that you've discussed. I mean, this is rehashing what we talked about in cabinet and how we landed at the 130. In my recollection, it was above districts that are what I consider to be the bigs, the four big districts in our county. It would bring us above them. So Atascadero, Paso, Lucia Mar, and ourselves, it would bring us above what they pay. But the higher paying districts for long term subs are those districts like Creston District, or Shandon, I'm sorry, Shandon, and the county office of ed, where you have a much more difficult time getting candidates to come out. So, and Templeton just recently changed theirs. So we went around at the cabinet level. I'm more than happy to re-engage the conversation and topic. I don't know if it's quantifiable. And I certainly don't know if we could pay enough to bring in a comparable level of talent, because I understand what you're saying, Dr. Eisendreth Rogers. I totally get that. And it's my view, a long-term sub is very important, But it's all using the rate on a daily basis would attract more, potentially more, but we even debated that concept. How much is enough? And so we landed on 130. We can revisit it and rethink it. I'm not sure there's a significant difference between 130 and 140 in the grand scheme of things in terms of what will appeal to someone. But I just believe that it is a difficult role regardless. And I understand where you're coming from. I honor that. And I'd be willing to go back to cabinet and rediscuss it, reimagine it, and bring it back to you.
And I think we should also be cognizant of the impact that it potentially could have based on the differential mm-hmm. that Chris raised, that for the regular teacher, if he or she does not have a large bank, then it's definitely going to impact that person's... So, Mr. Unger, then Mr. Quisenberry.
I'm going to make a motion, and I may need some help with it, but I'm going to make a motion that we accept the increase, that we immediately accept the proposed increase from $120 to $130 a day, because we do have somebody that is currently being paid $120 a day, and I would like to see that person make some more money. In addition, I would like the as part of the motion, I would like the administration then to bring us back for further discussion this item no later than, say, would the first meeting in February work for you guys? So that would be my motion. Okay, does that make sense? Mrs. Holmes, does that make sense?
Kind of. Could I have a little clarification on what you would like the board to discuss when it comes back to the
I would like to have the topic revisited by the administration.
Are you suggesting that the increase you're moving that we approved tonight would sunset then?
No, I'm not suggesting that it sunset tonight. Because that would be creepy to do, wouldn't it? I'm suggesting that we, in deference to the person
just
that's making...
discussion.
But I'd like to try to do both. So I don't know if I can get a second for that.
Well,
Mr. Quisenberry,
yes. Yeah. Well, I'm willing to second that. I think it's unnecessarily convoluted to have them go back and look at it until, let's say, the end of the year and see if they had any issues finding long-term subs. But... Just like I agree with you, I think I'm interested in seeing that whoever's currently doing it gets that $50 a week in their pocket. So I will second your motion, Mr. Unger.
Mr. Buckman?
I'm going to vote against this motion, and I'm going to vote against it because I do believe administration probably has done due diligence on this, I really don't. I'm not in the sense that right now I'm not in the wanting to second guess them. They're busy, and I also think doing this as a dual motion, as I understand what Chris's motion is going to add even more work for staff because they're going to have to implement the 130, then they're going to have to review it, and then maybe undo it. So I'm going to vote against this when it comes up.
Any other discussion?
Well, I'm going to vote against it as well because I think that it's in our purview to just go to $140, and I don't think that we have to. I mean, administration has told us that the $10 is not going to make or break anything. So I don't think we need to send administration back to confer on this. I think it's our job to make it a decision, and so I'm going to vote against that motion.
Okay, we have a motion and we have a second. And is there any further discussion, any additional input from the public? Then I guess we're ready for a vote. All in favor
of Chris's motion, which I don't know if I can restate. I think Mrs. Holmes can restate it if you would.
The motion is to approve the increase in the long-term substitute pay rate to $130 per day and direct the administration to bring the topic back to the board for a broader discussion in February.
Okay. At which time we would be expected to act upon it again to either sort of ratify that or change it?
That's what I'm asking.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Wi-Fi, which has been a great success, and we have hundreds of devices being ordered for Los Osos, being our STEAM school, and with the new Teach location, and getting ready for SBAC, and all of these reasons have caused an explosion and a great increase in the number of devices that we have at our schools, which is great news. But with that, we have a backlog of teachers, staff, students that are waiting for devices for their classrooms. And so we are recommending that we add a full-time computer technician position into the IT department in order to process these and get the devices in the hands of the students faster.
All right. I have a question. What is the typical wait time for service?
That's why Kim's here.
Kim.
it varies greatly depending on how complicated it is, software approvals or device repair, initial device implementation. You know, it varies greatly. It'd be hard to answer that on a specific basis. It depends on the complexity of what is asked. But we are, as you well know, we're increasing the number of devices greatly. And as you do increase that, you're putting a, you know, PC tech to device ratio is extremely high right now. So it's, in addition to devices, it's also software implementation. It's also maintenance of the devices, as well as implementation of new things, as well as just the everyday maintenance that has to happen for IT.
Okay, so I had heard the number like a couple of months, as long as a couple of months sometimes before someone receives attention. Is that correct? Or
There are some work orders that have been waiting a couple of months, yes. And a simple thing, you know, a printer connection or something, it may get resolved the next day. It depends on the level of complexity.
Any other questions from the...
I do.
Oh, Mr. Miller.
So if I understand the item, we do not currently have this position, position of this type.
We currently have four PC technicians that are servicing the entire district, all schools, adult ed, BG&T, district office, et cetera.
So why does the, so if we're adding one more of these already existing...
The position is correct, and then it shouldn't be a higher level or lower level position, but we're going to make the recommendation that it's a computer technician position, so typically the commission agrees with our recommendation.
I see. Okay, so it's not so much defining the position, it's what we're seeking fits into that category that already exists.
Correct. So you're saying, yes, we'll approve this amount of money for it, and then if we believe that it really is a higher-level position or lower-level position, they will say, no, we believe it should be a networking technician or something else. But we're pretty confident because we have four of these positions.
Okay, and so that's what the salary benefits estimate is based on. Okay, thank you.
Oh, I didn't keep track of who was first.
Marilyn.
Mr. Buckman, then Mrs. Roger.
Thank you, Marilyn.
I'll defer to you.
So I am just, wow. I mean, we're going full guns, and schools are getting to model, and the Wi-Fi went in, and it's really exciting. And I go sit outside of, Los Osos Middle School, and I have access, so I just do all my work out there. But this is more of a general question, and it may go to business, is as we put in Wi-Fi and as we know that hundreds of computers are coming in, is there some way that when we approve, I think it was $110,000 for Wi-Fi at some point, as we start doing that, is there some way to maybe anticipate staffing so that when we're approving the program, we're also looking at, geez, there's a possibility we might need two techs or one tech. And this is not just to the technology department. This is maybe for us as a board, or for me, excuse me, as a board member across, no pun intended, across the board.
Right, absolutely. We're looking at overall, as we move towards more devices, what an overall personnel plan would look like for an IS&T department. And you're right, each time we make one of those decisions, it has an impact on the type of maintenance and the type of implementation that's going to take place. And so, yes, we're looking at overall what would be needed long term. And you're right, things like Wi-Fi implementation, you can begin to estimate because you know that that opens doors, and then PTAs, you know, are waiting and want to help fund things. And, you know, we have PC replacement that we're beginning to work on. So you can predict
7-0. Thank you. Okay. Moving on to the action consent agenda, please let me know if you'd like any of the following pulled. 11.01, approval of certificated and classified personnel items. 11.02, disposition of surplus property. Okay, 11.03, acceptance of donations. 11.04, approval of furniture and equipment requests. 11.05, approval of purchase orders. And 11.06, approval of warrants and payroll. Mrs. Roger.
I'll move approval of items 11.01, 11.02, no, wait, I beg your pardon, 11.01, 11.03, 11.05, and 11.06.
Well done.
I'll second that.
Okay, we have a motion by Mrs. Rogers, second by Mr. Quesenberry. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Thank you. Mr. Buckman, 11.02, disposition of surplus property.
Thanks. When I looked at this item, I was, you know, we're putting a sea container up, and its value is zero, and my first thought was, so what's it going to cost to remove this thing? And, you know, it could be thousands of dollars. And so I talked to Ryan, and just for me, I was like, well, maybe we can salvage the metal, and I liked the answer I got, so I thought I would ask Ryan to just share it real quickly.
Yeah, so basically at BG&T, there's a C-train that's no longer usable. You know, basically we wanted to dispose of it, get it off of our property, and so we are going to, we do have some people that are interested in it, and so we are going to set up a bid process for people if they want it, but this C container basically has foam insulation in between the walls, so it's not something that we can use as scrap metal, you know, to be able to recycle it. So that was, you know, it was going to cost us $3,000 to dispose of this C-train. So now, by surplusing it, we're able to, you know, potentially make some funds and save on those costs.
So I would move approval then of 11.02.
Second. Okay. Motion by Mr. Buckman, second by Mr. Unger. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions? Motion carries 7-0. 11.04, Mr. Buckman.
Thank you. On 11.02, but two, I was hoping that possibly I, as one board member or others that would be interested, could get that sequence of playgrounds, because I'm getting asked sometimes, you know, when's our playground going to be? I'm sorry, Ms. Millar. You know, it's just, you know, I talk to five-year-olds and no, I'm sorry. Yes, I do get that question.
So, yeah, basically this particular playground is for Sinchheimer Elementary School, which is kind of next on the, in terms of looking at the facility itself and the outdated, playground equipment that's there, that it was kind of next on the list in terms of the audit that we did of all the playgrounds. So Los Ranchos has a couple of areas that are in need next, and so I can, you know, probably in like in a Friday notes, I can give you kind of a rundown of those things. Absolutely.
Sure.
So I move approval of 11.04.
I'm sorry, let me do that again now that I've rehearsed it. I move approval of 11.04.
Second it.
Okay, motion by Mr. Buckman, second by Mr. Quesenberry. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions? Motion carries 7-0. So we've done that. And any advance agenda items that anyone would like to raise at this time? Okay, and now we have the annual developer fee accounting. So this is just informational, so this is for us. Okay. Reports by board members. Mr. Unger.
I just want to say that on Sunday I attended a memorial service for Margaret Giever. And Margaret was the longtime librarian at Del Mar. She passed away in November from cancer. Her husband, John, was a longtime teacher for our district. He actually taught with my wife. He had two kids that went through the district programs. John, I believe, is his son, and Margot, his daughter. It was quite well attended at the Veterans Hall in Morro Bay. Many, many wonderful things were said about Margaret, and she will be missed.
Thank you. Anyone else? This meeting is adjourned. See you in San Francisco. Yeah.